Good afternoon. I want to welcome you all to this afternoon event today. Rich Lang, the pastor of this church, was going to be here to give a welcome, but he has a leadership training program this afternoon, so he can't make it. But I want to welcome you all on behalf of INOC, which, as most of you know, stands for the Interfaith Network of Concern for the People of Iraq. And so we just call it INOC, I-N-O-C. Many of us, and I would expect most of you as well, have been struggling for years with the Iraq issue and trying to obtain a change in U.S. policy on sanctions and the bombing against Iraq, and particularly then the devastating effect that that has had on the people of Iraq over the last 11 and a half years. And now with the horrific horrific effect of the terrorism on September 11th last year, our frustration has increased, and many of us feel that the response that has been given to that, the response in Afghanistan, is an immoral one, and that it is simply a continuation of a cycle of violence which could lead to much greater violence in the future. We hear from our president, as well as persons such as Senator Joe Lieberman, that it is now becoming time to, quote-unquote, finish the job and go after Saddam Hussein. These comments are being given despite the little attention is given to there being no evidence that Iraq has been implicated in the terrorism, that the coalition the United States has fashioned strongly opposes, almost all of them strongly oppose the war against a war against Iraq, and most Middle East Arabic countries as well are strongly opposed to removal of to change of that regime, that an invasion of Iraq could very well lead to a civil war, that the U.S. has no legal right to remove the head of state of a sovereign country. Further, our president tells us that either you are with us or you are against us, and nothing in between. And the mass media position has not been helpful on this at all, and has furthered the rhetoric that has been given by the U.S. administration. And there has been little interest shown in the possible role of the United Nations in resolving these kinds of conflicts. So we're frustrated and we're in a great storm as we struggle as to how we can be most effective in making the changes that surely must be made. But we're very grateful today that the Honorable George Galloway, Member of Parliament in England, is with us today, and I will call on Christine Swenson to make an introduction of Mr. Galloway.
Well, it was 1 year ago, almost to the day, I believe, I was in Iraq with a group from Conscience International, based out of Atlanta, and first encountered our guest today. And when I first arrived in the Middle East, I landed in Jordan and spent some time hearing wonderful stories from Mr. Galloway's wife about his efforts over the past 11 years regarding raising awareness of what is happening in Iraq and tugging at the heartstrings and the consciousness of people in Europe and the United States as to their role in what is happening in Iraq. We were fortunate, the delegation that I was with was fortunate to be able to fly into Baghdad. Unfortunately, Mr. Galloway just wasn't able to get on the plane at the last minute, although made a gallant effort, so had to drive across the desert, and I believe probably made it there before we did, after all the delays. But one of the stories I learned from his wife was that That would not have been his first flight into Baghdad. That at one time, he actually flew a private plane from London to Baghdad, and flew as an entirely peaceful plane entering that country. Another remarkable effort that he has made, I believe it was in 1999, he drove a double-decker bus from London to Baghdad. And you can imagine the attention that that gathered on the way, as well as the welcome that he received in Iraq. Although probably more remarkable than these individual efforts, I would say, would be the consistency by which Mr. Galloway continues to raise awareness, and I am honored to welcome him today.
Thank you. Thank you, friends, brothers and sisters, for that very touching welcome. I may say, if I can't rely on my own wife to tell nice stories about me, but I'm glad that she did. I should say that she is a Palestinian and therefore one of life's pessimists, and she did not believe, and probably because I've been unable to phone her, still does not believe that the United States government would allow me to cross the border this morning to speak with you. But I told her she was judging the United States just a little too harshly, though with reason, to which we shall return. I remember very vividly a year ago watching you take off into the sky as I had to climb for the 32nd time into a car and drive across the desert. The reason I was refused access to the plane was because the Jordanian Airlines telephoned the United Nations in New York, who refused to let me onto the plane because I was not, quote, a humanitarian visitor, unquote, so much as a political agitator. Well, I plead guilty to the latter charge, though I like to think that it does not preclude being guilty also of the first. But your delegation was a very important one. And in fact, delegations coming from the United States are arguably more important than delegations coming from any country. Perhaps my country would come second in that regard. And I want to develop an argument which says that this Anglo-Saxon alliance, this Anglo-American alliance, with little help from some other Anglo-Saxon countries, one of them to the north of here, is the problem, and therefore is the place where we have to win the battle that, as this wonderful poster says, she cannot be regarded as our enemy. Now, I'm very grateful to INOC for the opportunity to address you here today and to the campaign against the sanctions in Canada, which brought me across the Atlantic to the far western extremity, so far as my travels are concerned, of that great British Empire on which the sun never set, we were told when I was young. My late father used to say that's because God would never trust the English in the dark. And I suspect I never had any cause to doubt that wisdom. I make that point because I'm well aware of how perfidious is Albion, its historic role, and indeed its contemporary one. And I don't want you to feel aggrieved if I sound harsh in my criticism of the United States. In fact, in most respects, I'm regarding the two countries as indistinguishable, standing not so much shoulder to shoulder, as Mr. Blair likes to repeat, as us as the tail of the American dog. There's competition for that place on the tail. I think Canada's probably jostling us for it at the minute. But as we will find, and as I will develop, the tail never wags the dog. The dog always wags the tail. And that will become important when we look at the next steps in the so-called war against terrorism, the Operation Infinite Justice, Operation Enduring Freedom. I'm not making this up. That's what the war is called, Operation Enduring Freedom. Now, you might have thought that it was increasingly incongruous to call the savagery that's going on in Afghanistan anything to do with justice or freedom. You might have thought that when you saw the killing of, by American estimates, American academic experts who've spent a lot of time studying it, who tell us now that more than three times as many innocent Afghans have perished in the 100-plus days of war than innocent Americans who perished in the attack upon the Twin Towers. You might have thought it incongruous when you saw the prisoners chained, shackled, with hoods over their heads and sedatives forcibly administered coursing through their veins, being bolted to airline seats for a 20-hour airplane ride, not even allowed to leave their seats to relieve themselves, having to do it in their clothes where they sat, and then led off the planes and put in cages open to the elements. Where? In a country which itself has been on the receiving end of a 40-year terrorist campaign, mounted largely from the United States, financed largely by the United States. You might think that's the ultimate incongruity, that a war against terrorism could end up with prisoners being taken and explicitly described as not prisoners of war, even although the United States declared that it was a war they were fighting right from the very beginning, explicitly stated that these prisoners would not be treated according to the Geneva Convention, which presumably we must infer means they're going to be treated less well than the Geneva Convention, as opposed to extra benefits on top, which means, of course, that the prisoners will be treated less well than Adolf Hitler treated American, British, Canadian prisoners of war in the Second World War, because they were treated according to the Geneva Convention. And when you put it like that, you might think it's all very incongruous. But I want to argue today that there's nothing incongruous about it at all, and that the double standards running through the opening remarks that I've just made, the hypocrisy, the contempt for other people, which runs through the opening remarks that I've just made, are a part of the problem, a major part of the problem that we have in this confrontation, and it must be said to be a confrontation, between the West and the East, between the West, I'm not going to call it the Christian West, because that would be laughable. It's very far from being a Christian West. And the Islamic world, other parts of the globe too, but for the purposes of this meeting, we'll deal only with that particular confrontation. Now, a few weeks ago, Mrs. Blair, the wife of the British Prime Minister, made a radio address. It was the day after Mrs. Bush made a radio address. I may say it's rather dismaying that not only are the two leaders acting in concert, but even their wives are synchronizing their swimming in the ether. But both women invited us to remember, as if we could forget, the heartbreaking messages left from their mobile telephones by the women on those aeroplanes on the answering machines of their loved ones. Both Mrs. Blair and Mrs. Bush particularly paid regard to that. And they were indeed heartbreaking messages of love and farewell. But I said a couple of days later in the British Parliament, it was a big turnout, lots of people there, the Prime Minister and ministers were there, that, you know, just because Afghan women don't have mobile telephones and their loved ones don't have answering machines, it doesn't make their deaths delivered from the skies in terror any less tragic. Now you might think, because I'm taking it as self-evident that you're good people or you wouldn't be here, and we are in a church of God, you might think that's a self-evident truth, that Afghan women are the same value as American women. But as I looked around the audience to which I was speaking, it struck me that for the powerful in my country and yours, that isn't true at all. It can't be true at all. For all their actions, not only since September the 11th, but long, long before that, make it clear that they do not regard Afghan blood, Iraqi blood, Palestinian blood, the blood of poor people, the blood of people from poor countries, as being as valuable as theirs. That's the self-evident truth, not the first truth that I spoke. And you know, it can hardly be denied. The atrocity on the 11th of September committed in this country was a very great crime. But it was not the first crime. And it was not the biggest crime. And as we've seen, it was very far from being the last crime. Yet while the world shook and is shaking still for the 3,000 innocents who perished in New York, the world is virtually entirely oblivious to the many, many times that number dying as a result of Western policy, deliberate Western policy, in other parts of the globe. There have been no 3 or 4 minutes of silence for the 6,000 Iraqi children who died last month and who've died every month of 11 years of this embargo. I know that. I could show you my scars because I've been trying for 11 years, along with some of you, to waken people up to that mountain of dead children. Far from being 4 minutes of silence for those children, twice as many every month as died in the Twin Towers, they don't even make the news in brief in our newspapers. Even though who's killing them is not a crazed terrorist maniac, but us, our democratic, elected, civilized governments. No 4 minutes of silence. No task force assembled, no coalition built, no great earth-shaking effort to extirpate the cause of the death toll of Iraqi children every month. Every 6 minutes that works out at. I've already been speaking for more than 6 minutes. In the course of it, another Iraqi child died, and by the time I finish speaking, many more will be dead. And our countries, who are causing the slaughter, simply turn their faces away, pass by on the other side of the road, except where we pause to give the dead and dying a kicking as we go past. Now, for the avoidance of doubt, because I'm here in the United States and I want to get out in one piece, let me make one thing abundantly clear. Osama bin Laden has absolutely nothing to do with me or my political perspective. As a matter of fact, I despise Osama bin Laden and the obscurantist, medieval, reactionary interpretation of Islam which he has come to typify. The difference is, I've always despised Osama bin Laden. I despised him when the British and the Americans were giving him guns and money. Some of you may raise an eyebrow at that. Let me tell you that the bodyguards of Osama bin Laden were trained in what can only now be described as a terrorist training camp near Fort William in the Scottish Highlands, by the SAS, the Special Air Services, the very same SAS who are now hunting for him in the Tora Bora to kill him. If you'll allow me to quote myself, I said in the House of Commons 2 days before bin Laden and the other so-called Mujahideen drove into Kabul in triumph, I accused the then Conservative government of having opened the gates for the barbarians. And I said that a long dark night would now descend upon the people of Afghanistan. And so it came to pass. So I never accept any lectures from anyone about Osama bin Laden. But we have to face some very uncomfortable facts, and especially here in this country, which is striving might and main, shaking the earth, as I've said, dropping 4 days ago more bombs than on any other day of the war so far, for those of you who think it's winding down. They're doing everything they can to capture and kill Osama bin Laden. You have to face the uncomfortable fact that bin Laden slain by an American bomb or bullet may well prove more dangerous than bin Laden alive. Because so deep is the swamp of bitterness and hatred against us, which exists in many places, but for the purposes of this talk, I want to deal with the Islamic world, which I know well. So deep is that swamp of bitterness that already in the last 100 days we created 10,000 more bin Ladens. And when we kill this one, we'll create 10,000 more. Because although these aeroplanes came out of the sky on September the 11th, they did not come out of thin air. They came out of real life, real hatreds, real causes and real effects. And when I saw the American people in their agony, thrashing about for an explanation and coming up with explanations like they did this because they hate our democracy, they did this because they hate our freedom, they did this because they're jealous of us, my heart wept for the American people. For none of these things is the reason why this terrible thing happened. Now, as it happened, I was in Baghdad on the first day that the bombing of Afghanistan began, which happened to be the first day that Al Jazeera television broadcast the first videotape message from bin Laden, sitting in his cave with his Kalashnikov, talking straight to the camera. And I watched it in the lobby of a rundown hotel in Baghdad with a lot of other people, poor people, ragged people, shoeshine boys, men who bring the coffee, men with no jobs at all. And then the next day, going out of Iraq, I watched the same video being broadcast on the same station the next day in Jordan at a truck stop, surrounded by a large crowd of people, the same kind of people. And then on the third day, I crossed into Palestine for a day, and in Jericho I watched another group of people of the same kind watching the same video broadcast. And you have to know this. On all three occasions, the audience watching the television set turned from the screen, their faces wet with tears. Bin Laden really reached them with that broadcast. He really touched them with that broadcast. First of all, Muslims around the world looked at him who'd given up riches and luxury and gone to live in a cave, and they compared him with the puppet kings, the stooge governments, the generals, juntas, and 99.9% of the vote presidents who governed them, and frankly they preferred bin Laden. Not much of a contest, you might say. In the land of the blind, the one-eyed man being king and all. But definitely, They preferred bin Laden. And bin Laden very cleverly fired three principal arrows in that broadcast, each of which pierced the hearts of the audience listening. First, he said, the Americans will never have peace as long as the Palestinians don't have peace and justice. Secondly, he said, the Americans will never have peace as long as the Iraqi children are being slaughtered by sanctions. And thirdly, he said, the Americans will never have peace as long as they prop up the tyrannies which govern all the countries of the Islamic world. Now, I have to tell you, as someone who's spent the last 25 or more years deeply immersed in the Muslim world, that that's a very powerful manifesto indeed. It's a very, very powerful manifesto which touches the hearts of hundreds of millions of people. There are 1,300 million Muslims in the world. Let's say that they've got their fair share of people who couldn't care less. That still leaves hundreds of millions of people who burn with rage and indignation on these three points. And out of those hundreds of millions, tens of millions are ready to be the kind of passive support network for those tens of thousands, perhaps, who are so indignant and burning with so much rage that they're ready to kill themselves in order to hurt us, to make us aware of the pain being felt by the hundreds of millions who care about those three issues. Now, many Americans have asked me, well, what should we do? How can we dissipate this rage around the world which exists against us? And I say, well, the first thing you can do is to try and begin the draining of the swamp. The draining of the swamp of bitterness out of which these monsters flew on September the 11th. So let's go through these three arrows that he fired and see what the likelihood is of measures being taken by your country and mine to reduce the rage on these three cases. We have to face the fact that the Palestinian people have suffered in silence so far as the West is concerned, not since September the 11th, but for more than 50 years. Now, we're in a church, we live in a Christian country, so-called. I don't know about you. I don't hear many Christian leaders in my country expressing very much concern about their co-religionists, even amongst the Palestinian population, suffering. Never mind the fact that the holiest places in Christianity are today on fire. Manger Square itself, where Jesus Christ was born, is blocked by Israeli tanks. On Christmas Eve, buildings in Manger Square were on fire from Israeli shells. Jerusalem, in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, children are shot down by Israeli soldiers almost on a daily basis. Are we doing anything about it? And this is a question America has to answer more than any other country in the world, because you have to face this fact that General Sharon is murdering the Palestinians with American weapons paid for by the American taxpayer in the huge billions of dollars subvention which goes from this country to that country every single year. And when Palestinian leaders are assassinated by helicopters firing missiles, the helicopters are American helicopters and the missiles are American missiles, and the armed forces are paid by American money. And you expect to have peace? Is it expected that because we and our church leaders don't care much about what's happening in Palestine, that the Muslims don't care? That the Arabs don't care? That in their rage they won't, some of them, try to hurt us back for our absolute complicity in that crime? Well, we must have a very low opinion of them. We must think that they're people without brains or hearts or courage if we think that year after year they'll watch their own people being slaughtered with us as an indispensable accomplice in that slaughter and do nothing about it. Now, since September 11th, has anyone tried to rein in General Sharon? He's killed more Palestinians since September 11th than before. He's destroyed the last pieces of flimsy plywood architecture of the so-called peace process, which was signed with such pomp and ceremony on the White House lawn after the Oslo process. The day before yesterday, he sent his soldiers in to the Palestinian television and radio station and blew them sky high in front of the world's press. On the same day, they fired 7 shells into the governor's house in Tulkarm and have killed more than 10 people in the last 24 hours. So, no sign there then that we're taking action to drain the swamp. What about Iraq? Any sign that we're going to stop killing Iraqi children anytime soon? Unless a particularly chewy pretzel gets in the way, we're going to be killing a lot more Iraqi children pretty soon. The American war machine is girding up for another Gulf War, when the death toll will not be 6,000 children per month, but the whole country, indeed the whole region, may be in flames. And yet, most people in our countries are as yet largely unaware, and those who are aware, frankly, don't give a damn about the suffering in Iraq. I know that too, because like you, who have been campaigning on this issue, I've been trying to make them care. And they don't. They blind themselves with lies. For example, twice yesterday in Vancouver, a journalist and a member of the public said to me that, you know, the problem is the Iraqis kicked out the arms inspectors from Iraq in 1998. That's a bare-faced lie. The arms inspectors were withdrawn from Iraq in 1998 by us so that they wouldn't fall under the bombs that we then unleashed in a blizzard during Ramadan and Christmas, by the way, of 1998. But it just goes to show that Dr. Goebbels was right. If you repeat a lie often enough, people will believe it. So they blind themselves. They reduce 23 million Iraqi people to one person. Then they paint the face of that one person in such lurid colors that any crime against the 23 million is justified with reference to the venality of that one person, a person with whom, incidentally, we used to do very fine business, and who wasn't venal or demonic at all. Indeed, did our bidding in the Iran-Iraq war not so very long ago. And when I saw the very fine leaflet that this group has produced about their attempt to bring the Iraq's Philharmonic Orchestra to Seattle. My heart leapt because that's a very, very fine project indeed. And I know that orchestra very well. And I visited them in situ many times. And their plight, you know, sums up the plight of Iraqi intellectuals and cultured people, of whom there are very, very many millions. I hope there's no one here thinks, you know, that Iraq is some backward place. You know, the biggest library in the entire world was sacked and destroyed in Baghdad 1,000 years ago, when my ancestors were still living in caves and painting their faces blue. Iraq was writing in an alphabet, the first place in the world where an alphabet was written down, the first place in the world where crops were planted. The place which built this great library. And so there are very many cultured and intelligent, educated, intellectual people in Iraq, and their lives are hell. We sometimes concentrate more on the dead Iraqis because there's so many of them. But the suffering of the people who've lived through this Holocaust of 11 years has to be seen and touched to be believed. If you go into an intellectual's house in Iraq, the first thing you'll see is the bare patches on the walls where the paintings used to be before they were sold for the people to live. The internal doors in the house have been taken off and sold. Very few houses have doors in them, inside. You'll see their bookshelves bare, where the books used to be that they had to sell in order for their families to live. You'll find artists without paints, without paper, without the wherewithal to make their art. And you'll find the Philharmonic Orchestra with broken down instruments plastered together with sticking plaster and glue, with strings that can't be replaced. And you'll find men and women trying their best to dress as an orchestra should dress, and yet looking extraordinarily poor, shabby, and sad. So old are their clothes, so old and broken are their instruments, so unavailable is their music sheets. And I think if you bring them here, they'll help to melt some of that ice which has been packed around the image of Iraq, and I commend you for that effort. But you know, we're running out of time fast, because I believe that notwithstanding, and this is my point about tails and dogs, notwithstanding the fact that the British Prime Minister has made it very clear that he does not favour a widening of the war, does not favour an attack upon Iraq, he's about to discover that the tail doesn't wag the dog. And when the Wall Street Journal, to his great embarrassment, I'm sure, said on its front page a month or so ago that Mr. Blair is America's newest and best ambassador, they probably didn't think they were insulting him. The Prime Minister of Great Britain being described as an ambassador of another country. But, you know, we say that an ambassador is someone sent abroad to lie for their country. Well, an ambassador who's sent abroad to lie for somebody else's country is a very peculiar bird indeed. But he, embarrassed or not, he may very well be about to discover the limits of the powers of an ambassador who doesn't make decisions but merely goes abroad, if you like, to lie for them. The Arab countries are desperately scrambling to avoid a new Gulf War. Desperately. The Arab League General Secretary Amr Moussa, the former foreign minister of Egypt, was in Baghdad yesterday. He met with the president of Iraq for 2 hours. He made unequivocal statements, which I know because my wife has communicated them to me in the Arabic media, calling for the lifting of the embargo, demanding that no attack on Iraq or any other Arab country take place, demanding that the Arabs sort out their problems themselves, none of which has been reflected in the CNN, which is the only station I've watched, who managed to describe Amr Musa's meeting with Saddam Hussein as if Amr Musa had gone to Baghdad to warn the Iraqi government to comply with American demands, when the absolute opposite was the truth. When the General Secretary of the Arab League, speaking for all the Arab countries, said that a new Gulf War will be disastrous for all the Arabs. And the rulers of the surrounding regimes, the puppet dictators, you see, the problem with Saddam is not that he's a dictator, but that he's a dictator who doesn't obey orders. If you're a dictator who's prepared to obey orders, who's prepared to sell the oil at the price we want to pay, so that we can all run around in our four-wheel drives at very cheap rates. If you're a dictator who's prepared to invest the petrodollars you make in our economies rather than your own, spend the petrodollars in our bordellos and casinos and property markets and arms bazaars, rather than invest them in your own countries, you can be a dictator as long as you like. But these surrounding puppet dictators are absolutely petrified at what's coming next, because they know that so angry is the seething mass of popular opinion in the Middle East at the double standards that I've been talking about, that perhaps the regime change which comes about from a new American war on Iraq will be their regime, not the regime in Baghdad. And I know, because I've visited two heads of state in the Gulf in the last 3 months, and I can see the fear and anxiety in their eyes as they implore me to implore the British, to implore the Americans not to go down this disastrous road. And you have to face the fact that if you're going to make a new war on Iraq, it will not be one conducted from the sky. Iraq has suffered bombing for 11 years. You're not going to change the regime in Baghdad by bombing. You're going to have to put 100,000 or 200,000 Western soldiers, and I can tell you there will not be many volunteers from anywhere else, onto the streets of every village, town, city in Iraq, conquer it, then garrison it, while the flames lap all around you. And your people have to work out whether that's, to use the words of Madeleine Albright, in those words which will follow her to hell in another context, you have to work out whether that's a price worth paying. Whether you want to pay that price yourselves, whether you want your friends in the Arab regimes to pay that price, whether you want to add still further to the agony of the Iraqi people. And if you do, do you really think that'll make you more secure? Will it make more people or less people hate you, more or less intensely? Make it more or less likely that somebody tries to hurt you back one day, some way? You don't have to be Einstein to work it out. If more and more people hate you more and more intensely, you're in more danger, not less. And lastly, what of the third arrow? Are we doing anything to kick away the props that we've constructed around all these dictators and tyrants? No. We've actually corralled them all into Operation Infinite Justice and Enduring Freedom. Some of the most unjust and unfree countries in the entire world are members of our coalition. And we wave their presence like a flag, as if they spoke for their people, as if they were to face their own people. either in an election or one day on the streets, they would not be swept away by the hatred and bitterness of their own people. So that's why I say that Bin Laden slain is not the end of the problem and may even just be the beginning of a much bigger problem. Because we don't show any signs of dealing with any of those three planks of the manifesto that he cleverly outlined and which has support, passive and active, amongst hundreds of millions of people who aren't going to go away. I thank you for your attention. I thank you for the invitation. Thanks.
We have a few minutes to take questions. If you would speak loudly, and if you would keep your questions succinct.
Yes, I do. I think that the Muslims throughout the world were touched by the simple message that Bin Laden gave. And I reiterate again, I'm not pleased about that. I'm not in any sense here as an advocate of Bin Laden. Indeed, I was a bitter opponent of Bin Laden and the Northern Alliance and the Taliban and all these obscurantists. But I think that so wretched has become the political situation in the Islamic world that people look at Bin Laden and they look at their own rulers and they prefer Bin Laden. And we are to blame for that. I give just one example, if I may digress. Khomeiniism in Iran, for many people, came out of thin air. Where did this come from? How can a great country like Iran suddenly be ruled by mullahs whose thinking is in the Middle Ages? The answer is because Iran had a democratic, moderate polity, which was overthrown by the British with American help. Dr. Mossadegh, an educated, moderate social democrat who committed the cardinal crime of nationalizing Iran's oil, was overthrown, and then all moderate, democratic, centrist politics was crushed by the tyrant Shah, who was armed and supported to the nth degree by us, so that there was nobody else left to overthrow the Shah except Khomeini and the fundamentalist mob. And we're making the same mistake over and over and over and over again. And we're surprised that we've had to pay a price here in the American heartland. So many people seem to be surprised. It was heartbreaking to watch their genuine, naive surprise. In fact, the only surprise is that it hasn't happened long before now and hasn't happened more often and more dreadfully. Thanks. Yes. Well, I haven't read the book, but I'm familiar with the arguments and they don't sound at all surprising to me. As I said at the outset, America and Britain put these people in power in Afghanistan in the first place. They willfully did it. They knew the people that they were arming and financing. They knew what they stood for, but they did it. And the people of Afghanistan have paid a very high price. Now, twice they paid through having to live under these people, and then they paid again for the United States to remove these people. And the United States have replaced those people with people who are just as bad, and who are going to, once the cameras leave, govern Afghanistan in exactly the way they did before the Taliban came to power. So it doesn't surprise me. I know for a fact that Bin Laden was receiving United States assistance as late as the middle 90s to cause problems in China, for example, to infiltrate his Islamist fighters into the Xinjiang province in China, where there's a substantial Muslim minority, and to fan the flames of Muslim separatism in China. And he received money and he received weapons from the United States and assistance, logistical assistance, to cause those problems in China. I cannot prove, but I suspect that through Georgia, the Bin Ladenites were also supported by the United States in the activity in Chechnya. The Muslim separatist rebellion, which appeared to erupt from nowhere in the Russian Federation, it's very clear now, had a very substantial input from bin Laden. And I believe that Georgia, which is effectively an American base, Georgia in the Caucasus, was the conduit for American support to the Chechen rebels, because it's part of America's goal to keep China and Russia weak. That's why they bugged the Chinese president's aeroplane. By the way, there'll not be many presidents buying an aeroplane from Boeing in the future. You better come to terms with that. But the reason they bugged the Chinese president's plane is because they know that this window in which the United States is the only superpower in the world is a very short one. It's our bad luck, because we only live short time on this earth, that it might be a long part of our lives. But in historical terms, it will be a very short period of time. But they want to make it as long as possible. And one of the ways of doing that is to cause problems for China and for Russia, and to avoid the existence or the coming into existence or the strengthening of any other poles of power and influence and interest in the world. Well, Iraq's position is a very clear one, and I think it's entirely correct. Iraq says you can have weapons inspectors or you can have sanctions, but you can't have both. You had both until you withdrew the weapons inspectors just before the Desert Fox in 1998. And we will not, they say, ever again allow inspectors into the country while we're under sanction. Now, that's a very clear position. If the United States was genuinely interested in the arms issue, they would accept that position. After all wars have to end sometime. If you get the opportunity to leave a permanent monitoring apparatus on the country of your defeated enemy, most people would settle for that. The problem with the Russian plan is that there's not much point of Iraq accepting it if the US doesn't accept it. And the US has made it clear that it doesn't accept it. So Iraq will not state that it accepts it. But I can tell you, I think, without giving away any state secrets, that if the United States did accept that formula, Iraq would accept it too. They don't want to go on decade after decade in this dreadful situation. And they don't have weapons, as Scott Ritter made clear. Not a left-wing Massachusetts liberal, a right-wing Republican, former U.S. Marine officer, and extremely belligerent, hawkish member of the UNSCOM arms inspection team, who said in the British Parliament, I saw his lips move, that Iraq has been disarmed since 1998. And he said, that means that every Iraqi child who's died since 1998 has died under false pretenses. Has died, he said, as part of the longest-running international hoax. A hoax that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Indeed, he said, Iraq is the only country in the whole region that doesn't have weapons of mass destruction. So Iraq is ready to accept monitors, which I think is an indication that they don't have weapons of mass destruction. But only if the sanctions are lifted at the same time as the inspectors come in. I think that's the basis for a settlement. If it was put to a vote in the United Nations Security Council, it would pass with only one vote against. But of course, that one vote has a veto, and therefore it will not pass. I hope the Russian plan manages to persuade George W. Bush, but you've only got to say the words to realize how unlikely it is, because they're not interested in the weapons issue.
Would England vote for that?
I think so. I think they would. Britain, I should say, as a Scotsman. The gentleman asked if the British would vote in the Security Council for the Russian plan. I think they would. They won't if America votes against it, because they're the tail. But they would like to vote for it. But the United States would veto it. So I'm really not sure that it's going to be the basis of a settlement. As I say, it's much more likely that we'll be, by the time this comes up, which will be in the end of May, I suspect we may very well be in a new Gulf War by then.
We have another question.
I don't believe that there will be an international criminal court. I don't believe the United States will accept it. Henry Kissinger would be the first man on trial. Henry Kissinger killed... It's a fact, Henry Kissinger has killed more people than any other man alive on this planet. Directly. Directly responsible for the deaths of more individuals than any other person alive on this planet. And yet, far from being in the dock in an international criminal court, we must call him doctor. Which is a fraud, by the way. He's not a doctor. It's an honorary doctorate he's got. And like a lot of things about him, it's a fraud. So I don't believe we'll get an international criminal court, but I do believe that the sanctions are a criminal offence. Indeed, I argue the three I's, that the sanctions on Iraq are immoral, that it's immoral to kill people's children because of a dispute with their government. It's normally called terrorism. If a terrorist does it, if a terrorist takes an aeroplane and starts executing the hostages one by one until the pilot takes them somewhere, or the government that he's hijacking against decides to free prisoners or whatever, we usually call that terrorism. But what's effectively happened is that the West has taken hostage 23 million Iraqis and is executing them one every 6 minutes until the Iraqi government agrees to do what we say. So it's immoral. I believe it's illegal because it flies in the face of all the Geneva and other conventions which protect the rights of civilians, especially children, at times of war. And nobody can argue that we're not at war with Iraq. If you're killing their children every 6 minutes, you're blockading them, you're truncating their country north and south, you're flying over them and bombing them every other day, you're clearly at war with them. If something looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, the chances are it is a duck. So we are at war with Iraq, and yet we're breaking all these conventions which protect civilians, especially children, in times of war. So the sanctions, I argue, are immoral and illegal, but they're also ineffective. There isn't a single commentator who will argue today that Saddam Hussein is not stronger in Iraq now than he was before this policy began. And yet the purpose of the policy, the purpose of killing all these children, was presumably to force the people of Iraq to overthrow their regime. But they have not done so, and they are less likely to do so now than they were before we killed all these children. So a policy which is immoral, illegal, and ineffective sounds like a pretty lousy policy to me, and one which is long overdue for change. And that's the argument that I want to leave you with here today.
Thank you.
Thanks.